Okay, so it's Parshas Kisavo, page 1068. It's a longer parsha, but just not so many topics like last week. Just to go through, all the just the overview of the different topics of the parsha. So we have at the beginning of the parsha, which we'll go into a bit more soon. We have the mitzvah of Bikurim, the first fruits. We have a section called the Confession of the Tithes, which basically means that every three years approximately before Pesach, a person had to sort of make a declaration that he had given all the separations, all the tithes, all the things that had to give away to the Kohen, to the Levi, had all been taken, all been separated, and all been taken care of, and all been given over to the appropriate people, and it's nothing left in the house. There's a section in the parasha which talks about the relation between the Jewish people and Bnei Yisrael, the love that exists between God and the Jewish people. Then there's an interesting section which we'll go into a little bit towards the end about writing the Torah on stone. When they came into Eretz Yisrael, they had to write the Torah on the stones. We have the blessings and the curses on the various mountains. When they went into Israel, six tribes went on the one mountain, six tribes went on the other, and there was blessings and curses that were declared by the Levim or the Kohanim to each group, and that was part of the covenant that they were going re-entering into as they came into Israel. We have the last section this week called Reward and Punishment, Reprimand, called the Toichacha, which is a bit of a harsh part of the parsha. In fact, the minhag is to read it softly and quickly. Interesting, it's also that section of the parsha we don't call up anyone. The Baal Korah, the person who's reading the parasha, just makes the blessings himself. We don't want to make a big deal out of it. We don't want to draw attention, so to speak, to this section of the parasha. And then towards the end of the parasha, it talks about the 40 years the Jews spent in the desert and how now they are ready to understand God and to go into Israel and to be part of the whole process. Okay. So, we're going to just begin by having a look at the first mitzvah of the Bikurim. If you have a look on page 1068. Let's just read it through a little bit. We've done this once before. We'll try and go through some other aspects. So, the parasha says like follows. V'hoyah, top 1068. V'hoyah ki sove el aretz. It will come to pass. It will be when you will come to the land. Asher Hashem alakecha noisen lecha nachlo. That God, your God, is giving you an inheritance. V'yirishto, you will inherit the land. V'yashavtabo, and you will settle it. Once you've done that, V'lakachto mereshis kol pri ha'adama, you will take from the first of all the fruit of the land, asher tovi ma'atzach, which you will bring from your land, asher Hashem elokecha noisen lach, which Hashem is giving you. What are you going to do with that first fruit? V'samto batene, you'll put it into a basket. V'halachto alamokim, you will go to the place, asher yivchar Hashem elokecha l'shakin shmoisham, that God, your God, has chosen there to rest his name. In other words, you go to the temple, the Beis HaMikdash. Yep. Vasa la Kohen, you come to the Kohen, Asher Yiyah Vayom Heim, which will be in those times. Marta 11, you will tell him, Migadati Ayom La Hashem Aleikacha. I want to declare today to Hashem, Ki Vasi Al Oretz, that I've come to the land, Asher Nishma Hashem La Vesein Losses Lanu. In other words, I've come to offer thanks to Hashem by bringing the first fruit to the temple. What happens? Says the Pasuk, Veloka HaKohen HaTene MiYodecha. The Kohen will take the basket from your hand, v'hinichoi lifnei mizbach Hashem alekacha, and he will place it before the altar of Hashem your God. So that's what happens. The person brings the first fruit to Yerushalayim, to the Beis HaMikdash. The Kohen takes the first fruit and places the basket next to the Beis HaMikdash. Then there's a second part of this mitzvah that's very important. The part of this mitzvah is that the person bringing the Bikurim actually has to make a declaration. And the declaration is a brief history lesson almost. It's a summarizing the history from the time of Yaakov, when Lavan, his father-in-law, tried to prevent him from traveling back to the land of Israel, and he tried to destroy the family, until the going into Israel. Let's have a look at it. I've said this before, but it's like six or seven psukim which we quote in the Haggadah of Pesach as a summary of the story of the Exodus of Egypt, and we elaborate in the Haggadah, we talk about these psukim. Let's see just what the Pesachim says, right? Ve'anissa ve'amarta, says the Torah, when you bring the Bikurim, when you place it next to the Mizbeach, ve'anissa, you will respond, you will call out, and you will declare, Lifnei Hashem Alekecha, and you will say the following. You'll say, Arami Oved Avi, Arami, referring to Lavan. He wanted to destroy my father, Vayerid Mitzrayim, and my father went down to Mitzrayim, referring to Yaakov. Vayogar Shom, the same Ot, and he lived there with a very few people, Vayishom, the God, Lotzim, and Rav, and he became a very great nation. I'm just running through all the Psukim, you see the whole history there. And the Egyptians were very bad to us, and they afflicted us, and they placed heavy work upon us. Then what happened is, we called out to God, the God of our forefathers, God listened to our voices, he saw our affliction, and our efforts, and our oppression. And God took us out of Mitzrayim with an outstretched arm, with a strong hand, was running to you, an outstretched arm, God with great fear. Great awe of Isis, the Moses, signs and miracles, referring to the plagues and so on. And then, he brought us to this place, meaning the land of Israel. And he gave us this land, the land of milk and honey. And then the person bringing the Bikurim finishes off his declaration. He says, "Va'ato, and now, I brought the first of my fruits, Ashanasato li Hashem." And v'hinachto lifnei Hashem alekecha, says the pasuk, you will place it in front of Hashem your God. V'shtachavisa, then you will bow down. Third part of Bikurim, important part. Lifnei Hashem alekecha. And v'somachto b'chol hatov, you will be happy with all the good. Asher nasa lecha Hashem alekecha l'veisecha, that Hashem has given you and your household. Ata v'halevi, you, the levi, v'hager, and the convert, Hashem b'kevecha, that is in your midst. That's the mitzvah of Bikurim. Of course, basically, the mitzvah of Bikurim is this concept of gratitude, a sign of declaring everything belongs to Hashem, everything comes from God, and acknowledging that everything, all our blessings come from God, and we offer up gratitude and thanks to Hashem for all the blessings that He gives us. So I wanted to share with you a couple of things which I haven't done in the previous years, perhaps a different angle. A few things that we see in the mitzvah of Bikurim. First of all, I'll share with you an interesting concept which I just saw a few days ago. Someone gave me a new sefer. So, you know, always like to flip through and see what you can find there. It's someone that I know from who doesn't live here, and apparently they just reprinted the sefer a few years ago, and it's the ancestor of the person that gave it to me. A Kabbalist who lived in Tzvas, the sefer's name in Toras Aaron. So I saw it on the parsha, so I had a look, maybe something on this parsha that I could share. So he says a very esoteric, very cryptic thing, but he says a very interesting thing. He says the following. He says that the juxtaposition of this parsha to last parsha is interesting, because last parsha, the very end of the parasha, if you have a look on page 1066, ends off with the mitzvah of destroying Amalek, right? Remembering what the nation of Amalek did to us as we left Egypt, and remembering the war of Amalek, and the mitzvah to ultimately destroy Amalek, which was one of the mitzvahs that the Jews had, when they came into the land of Israel. Okay. Now, he asks a question, he says, if you have a look, then it goes into the mitzvah of Bikurim, so he wants to know the connection. But also, he wants to know, it's an interesting thing, the way our parasha begins, it begins with the word vehaya, it will be, which actually seemingly is a superfluous word. For example, in last week's parasha, which began with going out to war, all the Torah says is, ki seitze la mochama, when you go out to war. It doesn't say, and it will be when you go out to war, right? This phrase, Behaya, it will be, seems like an extra superfluous word here. We have it sometimes in the Torah. It normally expresses an expression of joy, as we've talked about before, Behaya. But it doesn't seem to be necessary here, this word. So he says, why is it here? So he says an interesting thing. He says, nothing to do with Bikurim, but it's got to do with the wording. He says that in the beginning of the Chumash, not beginning, but in Parshas B'Shalach, right? Okay, maybe we want to have a quick look at it. Hold the place where you are, but I'll show you where. Page 392, where we have the story of when Amalek actually attacked the Jewish people in the desert. You ever looked at the last line? Moshe Rabbeinu built an altar to thank God for the miracle. And he said the following, Vayomer, and he said, the last Pasuk, Tes Zayin, 16. Vayomer, and he said, Kiyod al Kaiska, for the hand is on the throne of God. Kais is like Kise, right? The throne of God. Which means Milchama la Hashem ba Amalek. God maintains a war with Amalek from generation to generation. Meaning it will be an eternal war against Amalek. And he starts off with the phrase that the hand is on the throne of God. It's like an expression of an oath. This is like an oath, swearing by the throne of God that there will be this war ultimately to destroy Amalek. Because we know, of course, Amalek was considered the worst nation. Not just because physically they attacked the Jewish people when they came out of Mitzrayim, but also spiritually Amalek is symbolic of the root of all evils, and the root of arrogance, something we've talked about many, many times. Now, if you look at that pasuk, there's an interesting concept here. When it talks about the throne of God, right, it says, Kais Ka, the throne of God, the chair of God. Normally chair is Kisei, so it's missing an Aleph. You see, that's a missing word. And also, normally when God's name is quoted in the Chumash, it's Yud Hey and Vav and Hey. Whereas in this passage where it talks about the war against Amalek, it's only Yud and Hey without the Vav and Hey. Which is also one of the names of God, as some come, especially in Tilly, we have that a lot. But nevertheless, it's sort of a half a name of God, but consider the name of God as well. So the rabbis say that what do we learn from this pasuk? That the name of God is not complete, and the phrase is, it says, Ein Shemoy Shalom, his name is not complete, Ve'ein Kisoy Shalom, his chair, his throne is not complete, until the nation of Amalek is wiped out. What, Amalek? Almost at the end. Sheikh's on the way, don't worry. It's coming. Right? I mean, one time in history we almost destroyed the whole Amalek. That was King Shaul, when he waged war against Amalek, but he left the king alive and let them work. So then Amalek came back again. Right? So this particular sefer says the following idea. He says, that's why we have this pasuk following in the beginning of our parasha, right away following what happens at the end of last week's parasha. The end of last week's parasha is the war against Amalek, to destroy Amalek. What happens when we destroy Amalek? Hashem's name is complete, and his throne is complete, correct? As we said, Hashem's name is incomplete, and his throne is incomplete until Amalek is destroyed. So as soon as we finish the parasha with Amalek being destroyed, what's the next parasha? The first word, first of all, is V'haya. V'haya, if you look at the word V'haya, which he asked is a superfluous phrase, but if you look at the word V'haya, it's got the full name of Hashem in it. Yud and Hey and Vav and Hey. Right? It's all in the name V'haya. V'haya is just the name of Hashem the other way around. You see that? That's why it's there, because now Hashem's name is complete, because Amalek has been destroyed. That's the connection between this word and the last paragraph of the parasha. And then he goes on and he says, that's with Hashem's name. What about Hashem's throne? So he says, if you take the word after V'haya, right? What are the next three words? Ki Savoy El. Kisava El has the gematria of 464. Right? 464. So Vahaya is Hashem's name, then Kisava El is the gematria of 464, which is the same gematria as Vehakisoy Shalom, the throne of God is complete. It said Hashem's throne will not be complete till Amalek is destroyed. It says Ein Hakisoy Shalom, but Vehakisoy Shalom, his throne being complete, it's also the same gematria as Kisava El. So he says that's what the level of remes, the remes of hinting in the pasuk, goes that the end of the parasha ends with Amalek, and what happens when Amalek is destroyed? We have V'haya, Hashem's name is complete, Kisava El, his throne is complete. So that's just an interesting remes. Now, it says in the pasuk, when you come to the land and you will inherit it, right, and dwell it, you bring Bikurim. So look what Rashi says. You rush it on your handout. Rashi says, "V'hoyok isavoy, it will come. You will come to the land. V'irishta v'yashavtabo, you will inherit it and dwell there." Says Rashi, "Magid, this teaches us shaloi nischayvu bebikurim, that the Jews were not obligated in the mitzvah of bikurim, atcha kofshu esaret, until they conquered the entire land. Shaloi nischayvu bebikurim, they will not." They were not obligated to bring the Kurim at Shekovshus, or so they conquered the land, Vichil Kuha, and they divided it. Okay? What does that mean? It means when they came into Eretz Yisrael, we know that they took 7 years to conquer the land of Eretz Yisrael and 7 years to divide the land of Eretz Yisrael, right? Says Rashi, that because the Pasuk says, it will... because the Pasuk says, you will come to the land of Israel and you will inherit it and you will dwell there, that teaches us that you're not obligated in Bikurim until you inherit the land, which means you conquer the land, and inherited means, which means you divide the land. In other words, you could think you're obligated to Bikurim as soon as you come into the land. Someone plants a tree and has fruit, right away there's a mitzvah Bikurim. No. We said there's mitzvah Bikurim only after you've inherited the land, conquered it, which means, and you've divided it. The problem with the Rashi is that he changes the wording of the Pasuk. See, the Pasuk talks about inheriting the land and dwelling there, which is a phrase that comes up often in the Chumash. But he changes it to conquering the land and dividing the land. Right? With me? Why does Rashi do that? So the Mefarshim explain that Rashi teaches us an interesting chiddush in halachic chiddush. The Torah says you have to bring Bikurim until you inherit the land and dwell in it. That could mean two things. It took them 7 years to divide the land. So you'd assume that when they divide the land in those 7 years, not everyone got their portion at the same time, correct? So it took time, it took 7 years. But some people, after the first year, were already settled. They had their portion, the land, they were farming, they were dwelling, they were set up shop, right? It took 7 years till everyone was finished. So now the question is, when do you become obligated in Bikurim? If I come into Eretz Yisrael and I belong to a tribe who was lucky to get our land earlier, and I plant a tree and I have fruits, does that mean I'm now obligated in Bikurim, even though the full 7 years is not up and everyone else hasn't got theirs yet? Follow? So if you just read the pasuk the way it seems, you'll come to the land of Israel and you'll inherit it and dwell there. So that means as soon as I dwell there, I'm fine. I have to bring Bikurim. Says Rashi, no. He changed the word. He says, no, the Gemara learns in this Pesukim that actually, it's not that way. That the obligation of Bikurim was only after they conquered the land, which is the first 7 years, and they divided it, which means all 7 years you need. Which means no one was obligated in Bikurim until the end of the 14 years. Now the reason this is a discussion was actually there's a precedent for it, because if you look back in Bamidbar, in Parashat Shlach, where it talks about the beginning, the mitzvah of Challah, it also says that the mitzvah of Challah began when the Jews came into Israel, didn't start in the desert. The mitzvah of separating Challah from the dough is also a mitzvah that only began once the Jews came into the land of Israel. Yeah. But there it's different actually. There we find that as soon as someone came into Israel, as soon as they made bread, doesn't matter what stage they were up to, but as soon as someone started to make bread in Israel and they had derived benefit from the land, they already were obligated to bring a challah. But here, for some reason, the mitzvah is different. The mitzvah is only once they come into land, only once everyone has been given their portion, they divided the land completely, which means at the end of the 14 years, then they become obligated in the mitzvah of Bikurim. Why is that? Why don't we have the same thing like Bachala? Why don't we say, surely the logic would dictate that as soon as someone has a field and he grows fruit, he should have the mitzvah of showing gratitude to Hashem, bringing the fruit, and as the pasuk ends off, that the gratitude should lead to a sense of celebration in the blessing that Hashem has given us. Right? So why in fact is it like that? We understand what Rashi is trying to emphasize those words, but why in fact is it that way that the Jews didn't become obligated in the mitzvah of Bikurim until everyone had received their portion in the land? So the Baba Chareba says an interesting concept on this. He says the following. He says, because Rashi teaches us an amazing lesson here. Amazing lesson is the whole aspect of Bikurim is gratitude. Gratitude for the blessings that Hashem has given us. And He's given us the opportunity to enjoy those blessings. And as the Pasuk continues at the end and concludes, V'samachta b'chol ha'tov, you shall celebrate all the good that Hashem has given you with the recognition that it all comes from God. The real celebration of blessing is the acknowledgement that the blessings come from God. However, one is not able to celebrate, truly celebrate, brachas when others don't have. The celebration is not complete. Hashem says, you're going into the land of Eretz Yisrael, You got your field first, but not everyone else has theirs yet. So you've grown fruit. You want to now come to the Beis HaMikdash or to the Mishkan or whatever it is and celebrate your blessings and show gratitude that Hashem has given you. You need to know that your celebration is not a complete celebration. You can't celebrate on your own. You only celebrate when everyone is celebrating the same thing. Everyone is enjoying the same bracha. And that's why that lesson is taught to us by the mitzvah of Bikurim, that in fact, they, even though they grew fruit already, and some people were farming already from the first year, didn't take 7 years. Some people were already growing fruit the first or second year, yet no one was obligated in the mitzvah of Bikurim until the end of the 7 years. But that's when everyone had the opportunity to grow fruit, and everyone had the opportunity to celebrate together and to join in to appreciate Hashem's blessings. And that's when they became obligated with the mitzvah of Bikurim. You know, it's an interesting thing that, because I want to just tie it very briefly, and we didn't say that, but just to try it very briefly to the concept of Rosh Hashanah. You know, Rosh Hashanah, of course, is the time that we daven. It's one of the focuses of Rosh Hashanah and Kippur is davening. We daven a lot for ourselves and the things that we need, and so we should. It's part of the judgment of Rosh Hashanah, part of Bakasha Sracha, part of davening, where we daven for the things that we need. But I think also part of the focus of Rosh Hashanah needs to be also davening for others. Understanding not only the needs of oneself, which is important, and that's what we daven for, and each person has a real need, and each person davens for their needs, but also to make sure to reflect on the things that are common needs and things that other people need, and to daven for others as well. The Chazal tell us that kolam ispalul ba'at chaveiro, if someone davens for his friend, hunan etchil, in fact, you get answered first. In other words, it's good for your own tefillah. Just that connection to other people, that concept of being together, the concept of understanding that true brachas that Hashem gives us, and the bracha that we daven for in Rosh Hashanah, which is the, you know, the chesiva b'chesima toiva, the good year, is really more complete when others have it too. So it's davening not only for ourselves, but davening for Hashem to give it not only to ourselves but to others as well. That concept of including others in our own tefillas. Okay. Now, still staying on the parasha Bikurim, I want to share with you something that the Sochet Shavah says of Shem Yishmuel. I've quoted from him before. I quoted last week actually. Back today, I'm going to share with you two pieces from the Sochet Shavah. He says like this, that the mitzvah of Bikurim is considered a very, very fundamental mitzvah. In fact, there's a medrash that says that Moshe Rabbeinu, he gazed into the future with Ruach HaKodesh, and he saw ultimately in the future somewhere the Beis HaMikdash was going to be destroyed. And that Bikurim wouldn't happen. Right? Bikurim wouldn't happen anymore. So what did he do? Moshe Rabbeinu arose, it says, and he instituted the concept of davening. Even though it was formalized later with the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah and then the Great Assembly, but Moshe Rabbeinu instituted this concept of davening three times a day. A davening three times a day would be the substitute for Bikurim. Yeah? So you need to understand, it's an interesting thing. What is exactly the connection between Bikurim and davening? And also, why three times a day? In other words, what's the concept of Moshe Rabbeinu bringing in davening dafka three times a day as a means to substituting the concept of Bikurim? And why was it so important to do make a substitute? When it says that Moshe Rabbeinu looked into the future and he saw the Ruach HaKodesh of the Beis HaMikdash was going to be destroyed, many things stopped when the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. Korbanos, lighting the menorah, bringing incense every day. There are many, many things that stopped every day once the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. Why did he focus on this concept of Bikurim? So first of all, we see from another medrash that Bikurim is considered a very, very fundamental mitzvah. In fact, it says in the medrash, Rav Huna says in the name of Rav Matna that the world was created in the merit of a few things, and one of those things is Bikurim. Seems like Bikurim is a very, very fundamental mitzvah. He says the following. So he says the following concept. Says, what is Bikurim? All right. Bikurim is gratitude, that's on one hand, but he says it's deeper than that. Bikurim is the concept, number one, to come to the Beis HaMikdash and demonstrate, right, that everything that we have comes from Hashem, number one. So that's the basic amunah, that everything we have, its source of the blessing is HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But not only that, by extension, what that means therefore is that everything that we have in life is for the purpose of serving Hashem, right? He doesn't bring this, but the Gemara says, there's a famous line of the Gemara, Ani lo nivresi ela l'shamesh eskoini. I was not created only for the purpose of serving my master. In other words, the real way to serve Hashem, the real meaning of avodas Hashem, is not that we keep the mitzvahs that Hashem gives us and then we have our own life. right? That's not true. In other words, that's not serving Hashem. That's just understanding that Hashem is in charge. He gives us certain mitzvahs to do, so we've got to do them. The real meaning of service to Hashem is that we live a life that is completely God-centered, which means that everything we do in our lives, from the time we wake up in the morning and until we go to sleep and everything in between, is a part of serving Hashem. Like the Pasuk says, "Bechol derechecha da'eyu." We say, I will know you, God, in all your ways, all my things. We should know our God in all the things that we do, we need to know God, right? Or like the Chazal say, "Kol ma'asecha l'shem shemayim." All your deeds should be for the sake of heaven. So there are certain formal things that we do, like mitzvahs, but then everything we do, whether we eat, sleep, recreation, business, whatever the case we do, it all leads to one concept, being for the sake of heaven and serving Hashem. Right? And he says, that is the essence of mitzvah bikurim, because when you take the first of your fruit, and before eating it, before doing anything, you bring it to Hashem, the very first, you're demonstrating that you acknowledge that God comes before everything else. In other words, the concept is, everything comes from God, and for the purpose of serving God. However, he says, that recognition, that acknowledgement can sometimes be incomplete. In other words, it could be conceptual, right, and theoretical, but not implemented, right? So he says, the way it happened is like this. If you look at the mitzvah of Bikurim, there were three components to the mitzvah. One was the action. Right, the action was to bring the basket of fruit, to give it to the Kohen, to place it next to the Mizbeach. That's one issue. Then there was a verbal declaration, the declaring why I brought the fruits, explaining it why, going through the history, thanking Hashem for being in Eretz Yisrael, and so on and so forth. And then the very end was the bowing down to Hashem before you leave. V'ishtachaviso, you shall prostrate yourself, you shall bow down. A mark of subservience. So he says, what's the concept of those three things? He says they refer to what he calls, different ways of calling it, but he calls this nefesh, ruach, neshama. He says, we operate on three ways. We operate on three levels. Where we operate is we act, we behave, right? The second is our emotions, we feel, and we think. Okay. What that means, often a person can behave, we can do things, but we're doing it only on the level of action. In other words, the rest of us is not there. We're not emotionally there, we're not intellectually there, and so on and so forth. Bikurim is such a fundamental mitzvah because of these three components. In other words, there are other mitzvahs that also demonstrate this concept that everything comes from Hashem for the purpose of Hashem. But Bikurim demonstrated on a deep level. The idea of bringing Bikurim is to do it on three levels to show that every part of us is part of the service of Hashem. Not just that everything Hashem gives us is for the purpose of serving Hashem, but that's that every part of our being has to be part of the service of Hashem. Action, number one. In other words, we've got to bring the Bikurim, we've got to put it down. The declaration, he says, refers to the emotion. It's explaining it and getting excited about it. The samachta, being happy about it, that's the emotional part. By explaining it, we know that words fuel emotion. So we explain it, we talk about it, and we get excited about it. So that's when we bring our feelings into it. It's not just a procedure, a ritual that we go through by action, by putting the basket down and bringing the basket, but it's something we start to live. And then he says that the third thing is the bowing down. What's the bowing down towards the end? The bowing down is a mark of subservience. When you bow down, you lower your head. Lowering the head is a symbol of making the seichel, the intellect, subservience to God. Right? And that's why it's such a fundamental mitzvah, because that encompasses every part of our avodas Hashem, every part of our serving Hashem. By the way, this intellectual part is a very, very important part. Part of serving Hashem is not just to do what the Torah says, it's to think Jewish. It's having the, what we call the hashkofa, it's having the philosophy, the outlook, the perspective, a Torah perspective. It's about looking at the world through the lenses of Torah. Belief, bitachon, hashgacha pratis, just understanding the world in a Torah way. Looking at life through a Torah lens, through a Torah vision, right? A very, very big part of serving Hashem. It's not just about doing the mitzvahs. Often people can do a lot of mitzvahs, but their thinking is very distorted. Their whole philosophy is not proper. in terms of their emunah, in terms of the way they think, the way they understand Torah, and so on and so on. That's why it's so important. That's why the Medrash says the world was created because of Bikurim, because this Bikurim symbolizes the commitment to serve Hashem on all three levels.
Can you just repeat those levels? You said there was
action?
Then you said something about three levels to act.
To act, to feel, and to think. So the acting is the bringing Bikurim, the feeling is the declaration, the talking about it, and the bowing down is the subservience of the thought. So he says, that's why Moshe Rabbeinu saw that Bikurim was going to stop, and he instituted tefillah, prayer, three times a day. He says the interesting thing, the Shem Yishvul, this is Trichilash, he says that the three tefillahs we know was Shachris, Mincha, and Ma'ariv, was made by Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, right? The three tefillahs, he says, represent, what is tefillah? Tefillah is a time of connection to Hashem. It's a time where we commit, a time where we subservient to Hashem, is a time that we give over our commitment towards HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we build that relationship. So he said, more specifically, what happens is that our commitment to Hashem through davening is also on those three levels, and those three levels are represented by Shachris, Mincha, and Ma'ariv, and Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. And I'm going to share with you what he says. I'm going to add a little bit to it just from other places just so it becomes even more understood. He says the following. We know Avraham Avinu made Shachris. Shachris, who is Avraham Avinu? Avraham Avinu represents, he works the other way around now. Avraham Avinu works the intellect. Because who is Avraham Avinu? Avraham Avinu brought faith into the world. He brought belief in Hashem into the world. He was the person who saw idols, he saw idol worship, he saw that it was silly. He fought against it, he broke his father's idols, and he brought the Torah philosophy to the world. He brought the thinking to the world, the belief system to the world. That's Avraham Avinu, and that's Shachris. That's when we Shachris, we commit ourselves to that level. And maybe that also corresponds to the whole concept of Shachris. Shachris is when the sun comes up. The idea of clarity. Right? First thing we have to have is clarity. We have to think, we have to believe in Hashem. We have to actually have the seichel right. Right? Then comes Mincha. Mincha, who made Mincha? Yitzchak. He says, Yitzchak, interesting the way he makes that connection, he says Yitzchak is the emotional side of it. Because Yitzchak was prepared to give himself up. You see, the difference between acting and emotion is, when I act, it's not me. When I feel, it's me. And that's represented in the fact that Yitzchak was prepared to give his person up, his body up to Hashem. He says, if Hashem wants it, I'm there. Right? And maybe that's representing, he doesn't say this, maybe that's representing the whole concept of Mincha. You know, Mincha is interesting. The Chazal tell us that Mincha is one of the most special tefillahs. Why? Because it's smack in the middle of the day. Like Shachris says, you can get it out of the way in the morning, Ma'ariv you can get it out of the way at night, before you go to sleep. But Mincha is like in the middle of the day when you're distracted. And maybe this is part of the idea, that when you, the difference between doing something and really living it, is that living it, you'll do it even when you're in the middle of something else. It's you. In other words, when you do something in the morning, okay, so it's convenient. Do something in the middle of the day means it's really you. You have a passion for it. Even when there's distractions and there's afternoon and things of business and whatever, but that's your focus. That's the concept of Mincha. And then finally he says the concept of Ma'ariv, and that's Yaakov. Yaakov represents action because Yaakov represents permeating the physical because we know that Yaakov's body was holy. It says Yaakov Ishtam. He was a perfect person. You know that Yaakov's holiness was so great in terms of his physical body that he gave birth to 12 children who were all tzaddikim, different to Avraham and Yitzchak, who gave birth to some children who weren't tzaddikim, and so on and so forth. And maybe also that's a concept of Yaakov going into places. Yaakov went to areas where God was so not obvious. What's the idea of action? Action means bringing everything of Yiddishkeit down to the physical. What's the physical? The physical is darkness. The physical is Myri. The physical is nighttime. The physical is where Hashem is not obvious. Right? When we learn Torah, when we think, when we have belief, that's more in line with spirituality, even emotion and so on and so forth. But action means that you bring it down to the physical level, to affect the physical layer of our existence, and that's the darkness of our existence. That's where Hashem is not obvious, that's where God is hidden, and that was Yaakov, was able to bring God even to those places that were dark, where Hashem wasn't obvious, and that darkness was much stronger. And therefore, that's the concept of Bikurim being related to the three levels of davening. And that's why it says that Moshe Rabbeinu, when he foresaw that their Beis HaMikdash would be destroyed, and there wouldn't be a mitzvah bikurim, he instituted the davening of three times a day. Because Bikurim is about recognizing everything comes from Hashem for the purpose of serving Hashem. Davening is the same thing, about everything connecting to Hashem, but on all three levels: faith, thinking, emotion, and implementing. So that's the thought he says on Bikurim. Okay. Now I want to just turn to something else in the parasha. Let me show you where it is. A very interesting mitzvah. Okay. Have a look on page 1072. Yep. Page 1072. It says, Vayitzav Moshe, everyone has, yeah? Vayitzav Moshe v'zikne Yisrael esom leimer. Again, this is the nation going into Israel, right? So it says, Moshe and the elders of Israel commanded the nation saying the following. Shomer es kol ha-mitzvah, guard this mitzvah, asher anoichi mitzav eschem hayom, that I'm commanding you today. V'hoya, and it will come to be, Bayoim asher tabris ha-yardin, that the day you cross the Yarden, to the land that Hashem is giving you, set up big stones, and plaster them, coat them with plaster. What are you going to do on these stones? The chasafta alayin is called divrei ha-toyra ha-zois be'avrecha. You will write on these stones all the words of the Torah, this Torah that I'm giving you. L'man asher tove el oret asher Hashem nesel ha erzol eschol v'dvash. Kasher dibur Hashem aleikacha. Asher dibur Hashem aleikacha v'sech alach. Right? In order that you will come to Hashem, you will come to the land that Hashem has given you, and you will fulfill this commandment. So essentially, the Yidden had this very, very strange mitzvah. That when they came to the land of Israel, they were supposed to erect these stones and write the entire Torah on the stone. So what is the meaning of this mitzvah? What's the purpose of it? I mean, it's not sort of often spoken about because like a small section of the parasha kind of, when everyone talks about this parasha, we normally focus on Bikurim or these kind of things, but what is this? What's the meaning of all this? We know that writing a Sefer Torah is an important mitzvah, but normally we do it on parchment, right? Parchment and ink. What's a parchment? A parchment is a skin that comes from an animal, which you work through, and that's, you know, you process, you make it into parchment, and that's what we normally write a Sefer Torah on, and that's what Sefer Torah has been written on ever since the Yidden went into Eretz Yisrael, right? Been going one Sefer Torah after another, linked all the way back to the Sefer Torah that Moshe Rabbeinu wrote before they went into Eretz Yisrael. He wrote 13 Sefer Torahs on the day that he passed away, one for each tribe, one to keep in the Oren, and that's how we have a Sefer Torah. And that's how it's usable. That's how we use the Sefer Torah. We take it out, we read it, and so on and so forth. And here there was a strange mitzvah to write the entire Torah not on parchment, but to write it on stone. What's the concept? So he says like this. This is also from the Shemesh, also from the Socha Chava. It's the Socha Chava Shira today. So he says the following. What is the idea of writing a Sefer Torah on the stone? The purpose of writing a Sefer Torah, generally, is, like it says in a pasuk somewhere, to write the words of the Torah on our heart. In other words, it's symbolic of us connecting to the letters of the Torah. Right? So he says that, he brings the name of his father, that part of the reason that we write a Sefer Torah on parchment is this. Because for Torah to be absorbed in the human being, Torah is a godly wisdom. Torah is the words of Torah are holy, the concept of Torah are holy. And a person just can't stump connect to the Torah. Learning Torah is not just a subject, it's not just an intellectual exercise. Learning Torah means the finite human being connecting to the infinite wisdom of God. It's a very, very powerful thing. Torah, by definition, the Gemara says, Torah kodma la'olam. The Torah preceded the world, which means the Torah transcends the world. The Torah is infinite. The concepts of Torah, although they are given to us in language that we can understand, but essentially, the Torah is God's wisdom which transcends the finiteness of this world. So in order to really build a connection to Torah, something we call in Pirkei Avos Kinyan Torah, to acquire the Torah, for the Torah to become ours, to become part and parcel of who we are, that requires a lot of preparation. It requires refinement. The person by default is not ready for the Torah. Just like the parchment isn't. This is why we write on parchment. Just like parchment for it to be something that you can write Torah on, it needs to be processed, it needs to be rubbed down, it needs to be chemicals, whatever you need, whatever is done to process the parchment. You soften it, it starts out hard, it starts out coarse, you have to make it smooth, you have to make it soft, you have to make it refined. That's symbolic of the person writing the Sefer Torah in their own heart, in their own personality. That for us to connect to the Torah, it needs a lot of work. We need to be processed first, we need to become more refined, we need to not just come with our full coarse arrogance and expect to absorb the Torah. It doesn't work. We need processing first before we can actually absorb the Torah. Which I think I've shared with you before, that explains also a phrase we say at the end of the Amidah. We say, just the last paragraph, before we take three steps back, we ask Hashem to save us from all bad, and so on. We have a few requests from God in that last paragraph. And one of the things we say to Hashem, "Nafshi ka'ofar lakol tiyeh," place my soul in before everyone as dust. "Psach libi b'soira secha," open my heart for your Torah. What's the connection between these two phrases? So before Hashem explain, that's the connection. The connection is that without humility, you can't absorb Torah. So we say, "V'nafshi ka'ofar lakol tiyeh," my heart should be like dust. In other words, I should be humble, just like sand. And then, open up my heart in Torah. In other words, then I'll be able to absorb Torah properly. The problem is, he asks, it's a bit of a vicious circle. Because, how do you process yourself? How do you learn humility? How do we learn to become more refined? How do we learn to shed our coarseness and to have a spirit of more of a refinement? The only way is through the Torah. Torah is called Torah Oyer. Torah is the guiding light. So how does it actually work that we say that in order to absorb Torah, you need a whole preparation of processing ourselves to become more refined and humble? Where the only way to do that is with the Torah. So what starts first? The chicken or the egg? How does it work? How do you? It's like a vicious circle. How does it all work? So he says the following very interesting concept. He says Torah connects with us on two levels. As we've talked about many times, we all have a godly soul and an animal soul. There's two parts of our personality. There's a godly part of our personality and there's a coarse part of our personality, an animalistic part of our personality. The neshama, the godly soul, doesn't need processing to absorb the Torah. Right? When we learn Torah, the neshama gets it right away. The neshama and Torah are one. The Zohar says, Yisrael oiraiso v'kutsho brichu kulocha. The Yidden, Torah, and God are all one. The Neshama has an intrinsic connection to the Torah. And that Neshama connection with the Torah is eternal, it can never be broken, and it's completely united. It's what we call, he doesn't bring this concept, but it's the same similar idea. The words of Torah on the Neshama are like stone that is engraved with the words of Torah. What's the difference between a Sefer Torah and a Luchos, for example? Or what's the difference between a Sefer Torah and stones that have been engraved with words of Torah? A number of things. First of all, a Sefer Torah is made out of parchment. It comes from an animal, and by definition, it can erode. In other words, it's not forever. The pieces of the parchment wear out after a while. That's how we check our mezuzahs every so often, because one of the things that comes to mezuzahs is the parchment can be worn out, right? Secondly, we know that when you write a Sefer Torah, or you write anything on paper, although there's a tremendous connection between the ink and the parchment, they become one thing, but actually don't become completely one thing. There still remains a possibility for the letters of the ink to jump off the parchment. In fact, it also happens in a Sefer Torah sometimes, where sometimes the letter is no longer there. It's the ink has been peeled off. Right? Because it's not completely one thing. They're connected, but it's not completely one thing. When you write words of Torah on a stone, it's different. The stone, number one, is much more long-lasting than the parchment is. Stones have a certain level of eternity to them. In other words, as long as the world is around, the stones, the mountains are still there. And also, when you engrave something on a stone, the letter and the stone becomes one thing. Right? The letter and the stone become one thing, one entity. You can't separate between the letters unless you break the stone. You can't rub out the letters unless you break the stone. Yeah. There's a story of the previous Lubavitch Rebbe. He once sent someone to a town to, or a Rav once came to him and told him that he went to a town of Yidden who were very far away from Torah Mitzvahs, and he spoke to them. He said, "What are you telling?" He said, he told them, like this was trying to inspire them. He said, he told them that it says that the word Yisrael, right, we are called B'nai Yisrael, the word Yisrael is an acronym. It stands for Yesh Shishim Ribui Oisiyas LaTorah. There are 600,000 letters to the Torah. Which means just like there are 600,000 souls, there are 600,000 letters to the Torah, and every neshama is connected to one letter of the Sefer Torah. So he told them that every Yid has a connection to the Torah, and therefore every Yid is like a letter of the Torah, and you need every letter in the Torah, so every Yid is important, and so on and so forth. And then he told them, this is how he's speaking the shul, he said, but just like a Sefer Torah, you can have a letter that can crack or can become invalid, can become puzzled, can become written incorrectly, so too you can have a Yid like that, and therefore you have to fix the Sefer Torah. And that was the idea, the call to tshuva, the call to come back. So he told the Rebbe this speech that he gave. The Rebbe said it was a very, very good word. You made one mistake. He said, instead of telling him that there are letters of a Sefer Torah, you should have told him there are letters engraved in a stone. That's the type of letters they are. They're the letters engraved in the stone. Why? Because a Yid's ultimate connection with Torah is eternal, cannot be broken. A Yid and the Torah are one thing on the neshama level. Right? And that's what you should have told him, is not that the letter can be destroyed. The letter can become dirty sometimes. You have to clean it up. You can't see the letter. The letter's there. Right? You can have stones and a letter, a letter's on a stone that can be filled with dirt, and therefore you can't see the letter, but the letter's still there, so you have to clean it out. What's the point? The point is that on the neshama, there's already the words of Torah, they're already absorbed into the neshama, and they're one, and it's eternal. When we talk about the processing and the refinement and the humility that we need to work on ourselves to absorb the Torah, that's a second level of Torah. That's to get the Torah to go beyond the neshama. It's to get the Torah to go beyond the neshama and to have an effect on every part of our personality. That's referring to the concept of absorbing the Torah not only in our neshama, but absorbing the Torah and having the Torah impact and have an effect on even our nefesh habamish, even our animal soul. Every part of our personality has to be connected to the Torah. And that's where we need work. Because every part of our personality is not ready for the Torah. That's where we need to use humility, we need to process it, we need to work it out a little bit. Push ourselves a little bit. Process ourselves a little bit so we become soft enough and refined enough to absorb the Torah. So we ask the question, but you need the Torah for that. The answer is, yes, we have the Torah. We have the Neshama Torah. The Neshama has the Torah. So we use the power of the Neshama's connection, which it already has for the Torah, to process the body, the animal soul, for the animal soul to become ready to absorb the Torah. That's how it works. Right? And that's why when we talk about the Sefer Torah, writing a Sefer Torah on parchment, the reason that we all write a Sefer Torah on parchment is because the ultimate goal is not for the Torah to remain on the written, on, engraved in the neshama. The ultimate goal is for the neshama, the Torah to be written on the animal part of who we are, parchment. That's a symbol of the parchment. That every part of our personality, even the animal part of our personality, should have the Torah absorbed in it. So it says this is the pshat of this mitzvah. When the Yidden were into Eretz Yisrael, it was a new start, new beginning. Says Hashem, what you got to do is, first of all, before you start writing more Sefer Torahs, you've got to erect stones. And write, engrave the whole Torah on these stones. So that you should always be a reminder that the starting point is there. The Sefer Torah, the Torah on the Neshama is always there. Engraving the letters of the Torah on the stone is the letters of the Torah on the Neshama. That's always there. It's eternal, it's there, it'll remain there. Now you need to, once you've done that, then you need to use the power of that connection you have with the Torah intrinsically to process the animal part of your personality, to make it ready and fit and refined enough to absorb the Torah, and then to let the Torah be absorbed in every part of you, which is then subsequently what you do when you want to really learn Torah. You write the Torah on parchment pieces of a Sefer Torah. But first you need to understand that we have the Torah written on the stone. What's that? That's the Torah on the Neshama. Then with that koyach, we can go to the Neshama written on parchment. The Torah written on parchment, which is the Torah permeating and affecting every part of who we are. Okay, stop there.